This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
When the atmosphere is loaded with extra warming gases, extreme weather appears all over the world. The latest outbreak is a giant combination of heat and drought over most of India and neighboring Pakistan. When the thermometer goes over 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 49 Celsius, it's deadly. Is this Indian heat emergency just natural variability, El Nino, or a preview of an unstable warming world? Here to help is Dr. Michael Wehner. He's a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Dr. Wehner specializes in extreme weather events from rainfall to heat waves. He's published on the heat wave in Pakistan 2015. And he's watching this year's relentless heat in India as another case. Michael Wehner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
What is your first take on this record-breaking heat wave that enveloped India in the spring of 2016?
Well, it's surprising because last year was also record-breaking in many ways in India. And the consequences on human health and well-being can be quite severe, and my sympathies go out to the people that are affected. From a scientific point of view, these kinds of heat waves are very interesting. Of course, it's always been the case that there have been both heat waves and cold snaps that arise out of the natural variations in the climate system that we call weather. What we have learned recently is that we can actually determine in some probabilistic manner the effect that the human interference in the climate system has had on extreme weather events, if there is one. Sometimes there's not. But heat waves, in general, have some sort of detectable and attributable contribution. And, of course, this heat wave, just having occurred, it's a little difficult to say that with any authority. But it has been our experience that every major heat wave in the last several years that has been studied has shown some human influence. And by the human influence, I mean it is either more likely to have occurred and reached the temperatures that were actually measured, or conversely, if you consider an event of a fixed rarity, it's a little bit hotter.
You know, Western media have done a lousy job covering this heat emergency in India, and it's embarrassing to ask, but why should my listeners in North America or Europe care about it?
Well, I think we should care, if for no other reason, the human tragedy. But I think it's not a wake-up call for me. I mean, maybe it should be a wake-up call for some, that global warming has an effect that is, like I said, detectable and attributable right now. So this is not something that's occurring in the distant future. You know, maybe a lot of what people have read are about things that are going to happen 100 years from now. And in fact, you know, I've written a lot of that. But, you know, this is something that's here and now. And it's not just in India. The Texas heat wave in 2011 was shown to have the chances of reaching that level of severity were doubled by human changes to the composition of the atmosphere. Similarly, in Europe, in 2003, and again in 2012, and again last year, the human influence was shown to be even greater than that in the most recent ones. And this is true all over the world, that in general, heat waves have become a little bit more severe because of the global warming.
And these things can have geopolitical impacts. I'm thinking of the Russian heat wave in 2010, where the harvest was gone bad and they had to limit exports. And one of the world's biggest importers of wheat, Egypt, went into unrest, the Arab Spring. What do you think about the geopolitical impacts of these things?
Well, I don't think that in a global economy, and particularly in a global agribusiness economy, there are long, what we would call in meteorology, teleconnections, you know, long distance effects from something happening in one part of the world. And the food economy is so interconnected that a crop failure in one part of the country, in one part of the world, can cause undue stress in other parts, and particularly in poorer developing nations, where the fraction of income that anybody earns that is spent on food is much larger than in the fully developed nations. You know, that this connection between crop failures in one part of the world and political unrest in another is an interesting one. It's quite plausible. It's you know, as a physical climate scientist, it's I realize how difficult it is to make a quantitative statement about such things.
Do you see a developing relationship between climate-driven weather extremes and the refugee crisis?
Well, this is something I also, again, would believe is quite plausible, but again, a difficult thing to show causality on. But I think in many ways we've only seen the tip of this problem, this iceberg of a problem. The amount of climate change we've had since the pre-industrial age is about 0.85 degrees centigrade. Now, in any plausible future scenario, 2 degrees of warming is almost virtually certain. You know, this is the target that the Paris meeting, the Conference of Parties, COP21 it was called, agreed to, and they wanted to further limit to 1.5 degrees. But these targets are so difficult to meet that there will have to be substantial reductions in the consumption of fossil fuels across the world, not just in the United States, although the United States would have to seriously move towards a carbon-free economy. That I actually am very pessimistic that these targets would be met. Rather, you know, the most plausible ones that I believe are the so-called business-as-usual scenarios, which by 2100 lead to somewhere between 3.5 and 6 degrees warming. Now, these are planets that we have no experience with, and it is highly unlikely that there wouldn't be dramatic social upheavals. And so, you know, you can be as pessimistic as you like on this, but you know, the best case scenario is that there's twice as much warming as we have already experienced, and we are already seeing impacts on people's well-being.
And you published on these different pathways in the journal Climatic Change with Claudia Tibaldi. The title is Benefits of Mitigation for Future Heat Extremes under RCP 4.5 compared to RCP 8.5, and that's sort of a middle path and the worst case path. What did you find in that paper?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't call the difference between a worst case path and a middle path. It was the difference between a rather dramatic reduction in carbon fuel consumption and the worst case that we considered. Now, you have to understand that the worst case we considered, and this was something that was developed for the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, fifth assessment report, which Claudia and I actually were both lead authors on. These scenarios of a future climate were constructed back around 2005. And so we know where we are relative to that worst-case scenario. And in fact, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is actually higher than what we thought was the worst-case scenario just 10 years ago. So that being said, what we found is that doing this rather dramatic reduction did have tangible benefits to reducing the future increased frequency of heat waves. What I mean by that is that even in this dramatic reduction of carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere, the changes to the frequency and magnitude of heat waves is profound, but it's not as bad as if we don't do anything at all. And so the title was chosen to be positive, and we can credit Claudia for that. She's a very positive person. There is a very real benefit that would translate to social benefits to the rather large investments that would be required to change our consumption, our patterns of consumption of carbon dioxide. But I think it's important to remember that we're not off the hook.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Michael Wehner from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. We're talking about killer heat waves and climate change. All right, now in 2015, there was a similar massive heat wave in Pakistan, and at least 1,000 people died in Karachi alone. You published a paper on this. I'm not familiar with this. What was the title of that paper?
Well, actually, that paper is in review right now. So we'll see how it goes. And off the top of my head, I don't remember the title. I think it's called The Deadly Heat Waves in Pakistan and India in 2015, or words to that effect. The interesting question when we started that work was, there were deadly heat waves in both India and Pakistan. They were separated by about 5 weeks. And so the first question was, how are these two heat waves related? And I honestly didn't know when we started. And what the answer was is that they're not actually related. The heat wave in India was due to a delay in the onset of the monsoon, which sometimes happens when the monsoon is delayed. is that winds come from Pakistan and overland into central and eastern India, and they're hot and dry. And that was the cause of the 2015 Indian heat wave. In Pakistan, by the time the Pakistani heat wave had happened, which was late June, early July, in India the monsoon had fully developed. And so it rained, it was cooler. And in fact, especially in Karachi, which is the weather station that we use for this analysis, the winds had changed so that in Pakistan they were coming off the ocean, but it was still hot. And so it was hot and humid in Karachi. So in India, up until this year, actually, it was the hottest in some places that had ever been observed, but it was also dry. In Karachi, the temperatures were not the record temperatures, but the combination of heat and humidity were indeed records, as best as we can tell from the observations we have. In heat waves, the combination of high heat and high humidity is especially deadly.
And critics say some of those deaths in Pakistan in 2015 were preventable. What can governments or NGOs in developing countries do to help their populations survive extreme heat?
Well, this is a really, really good question, and one that is close to our present and future research. And this is what we found, especially in Pakistan, is that there wasn't enough warning for people to prepare. And then when the heat wave did really come into full swing, services, public health services, were overwhelmed. They were coming into hospitals at a rate greater than they could be treated or admitted, in fact. So what could NGOs do? They could help in two ways. One is in developments of early warning systems. These heat waves can be predicted several days at least in advance, if not a week or so. And so preparations could be made. But more in the long-term sense, infrastructural improvements are needed, especially in developing nations. But I should add this could happen anywhere. In the Paris heat wave of 2003, many tens of thousands of people died because of that event. And part of that was because of social practices. And so, you know, what can be done in the United States and the developed nations? And this is interesting. Some cities, especially Philadelphia, have plans in place to check on the vulnerable. Now, who are the vulnerable in a heat wave? Well, oftentimes it's the very old, the very young, of course, too. But it's the very old and the poor. So systems that make sure that that these people are okay, you know, can really go a long ways to reducing the death toll.
So if the world continues to depend mainly on fossil fuels well past 2050, and that's what it looks like right now, how hot can it get?
Oh, this is the big question. Like I said, by the middle of the century, we should expect a minimum of at least another degree centigrade, which is about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, warming over now. And that's pretty much independent of what future scenario of greenhouse gas emissions we take. And that's one of the things about climate change, is that there's no immediate gratification to a change in the patterns of consumption of fossil fuels, because the climate system reacts relatively slowly. And so if we act now, we shouldn't expect too much of a change in the variety of things that could happen by the middle of the century. Where we would see that is like 2075 and afterwards. This is one of the things that makes climate change a difficult political issue, is that in order to realize any actual benefits, one has to take the actions long in advance of those benefits being realized.
Yes, the Save the Next Century movement isn't that strong.
You have to have an overriding concern for the welfare of your grandchildren and others, and other people's grandchildren as well, I should add.
What climate research interests you the most these days?
What I think is the most interesting area is the intersection of physical climate scientists like myself with social scientists. That is the most exciting thing that I'm involved in. And the reason it's exciting is because the conversation has only really begun to happen. My principal colleague is Federico Castillo at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's from Costa Rica. And when I teach in his class, I tell them that the big challenge we have is the language difference, and I'm not talking about the Spanish-English thing. and everybody laughs, because what I'm really referring to is the difference between talking to an economist and a climate scientist. We have different ways of looking at the world and different ways of doing our science, and bridging that gap is challenging but really interesting.
We'll have to leave it there. We've been speaking with climate and weather expert Dr. Michael Wiener. He is a senior staff scientist at the Computational Research Division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. He studies and publishes new science about the relationships between climate disruption and extreme weather events, and I'll put some links to all of that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Well, Michael, thank you so much for helping us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.